All right, so let's dive into a case today that might surprise some folks, you know, how relevant it is, even though it goes all the way back to the 1980s, Jacobson v. United States.
Oh, yeah.
It's all about entrapment, which,
Right.
I mean, any lawyer will tell you that is a tricky area of the law,
And
especially
she's right.
today with so many online investigations happening.
Especially now, yeah.
Yeah.
It really gets to the heart of, what's permissible for law enforcement to do when they're trying to catch criminals.
Right.
Can they push someone into committing a crime that they wouldn't have otherwise?
Right.
That's the line that Jacobson tries to draw.
So for our listeners who might not be familiar with this case, let's start with the basics. It all begins back in 1984 with a Nebraska farmer
Okay.
named Keith Jacobson.
All right.
He ordered some magazines called Bear Boys, which at the time were considered legal because they didn't meet the threshold for
Right.
sexually explicit material.
Yeah.
Then things changed.
So Congress passed the Child Protection Act
Oh, wow.
that same year, and suddenly possessing materials that were once legal could land you in trouble. Jacobson's name, because of his previous order, ended up on a government mailing list.
Oh
And
no.
what followed was a 26-month campaign by government agencies targeting him.
Wait, 26 months? That's over 2 years. What exactly were they doing all that time?
Well, it started subtly.
Oh.
They sent him solicitations for magazines
Ooh.
featuring adult nudity, which was still legal, to
Yeah.
see if he'd bite. And he did subscribe to some,
Okay.
but then they escalated
This
things.
is where it starts to feel a bit icky, right? They weren't just giving him an opportunity, they
Yeah.
were actively trying to like influence him.
Exactly. They created fake organizations, some claiming to fight censorship, others promoting sexual freedom. They used these fronts to send Jacobson questionnaires and surveys explicitly asking about his sexual interests, including his thoughts on child pornography.
Oh, wow.
They even had a survey from a made-up group called the American Hedonist Society.
So they weren't just fishing for information. They were throwing out some pretty loaded bait.
Yeah.
It sounds like they were trying to gauge his reactions, maybe even plant ideas.
And it didn't stop there.
Oh, gosh.
They sent him letters arguing against censorship and defending the right to access any type of material,
Right.
even appealing to his patriotism.
So were they basically trying to make him feel like he was standing up for freedom of speech
Right.
by supporting access to illegal material? That's a pretty manipulative tactic.
That's precisely what the defense argued later on.
Yeah.
They claimed that the government wasn't just gathering information, they
Correct.
were actively trying to create a criminal motive
Yeah.
to normalize something that was now clearly against the law.
It's kind of chilling when you think about it. The
Yeah.
government spending 2 years trying to make someone commit a crime.
Right.
So after this relentless campaign, did Jacobson finally crack?
They did.
Oh, wow.
After 2.5 years, he ordered a magazine containing child pornography. The government swooped in and arrested him.
Okay.
But here's where things get really interesting from a legal perspective.
Okay.
When they searched his home, they found absolutely no other illegal materials
Really?
except for what the government had sent him.
Hold on. So the only evidence they had was what they themselves provided. That seems like a pretty flimsy case.
It does raise a huge red flag.
Yeah.
And this is where the whole concept of entrapment comes into play.
Right.
The core question is, did the government prove that Jacobson was already predisposed to commit this crime, or did they manufacture that predisposition through their campaign? Remember, to secure a conviction,
Right.
they needed to prove his intent existed before their involvement.
That distinction between simply offering an opportunity versus actively creating the criminal intent is crucial, isn't it?
Yeah.
And this case really puts it under a microscope.
Exactly.
What did the Supreme Court ultimately have to say about all of
Well, this
this?
is where it gets even more fascinating. The
Yeah.
court was deeply divided, with a 5-4 decision ultimately siding with Jacobson.
Wow, so they were essentially saying that the government can't create a criminal out of thin air. Wow.
Exactly.
Okay.
Justice White argued that while Jacobson might have shown some interest in bear boys, which was legal at the time,
Right.
that only indicated a generic curiosity, not a predisposition to break the law.
Right.
They weren't convinced that the government had proved beyond a reasonable doubt that his intent existed independently of their actions.
That's a really important point, especially for our listeners who are practicing lawyers
Yeah.
or studying law. This
Absolutely.
idea of beyond a reasonable doubt is the bedrock of our justice system.
It is.
But we can't forget about those four dissenting judges. What were
Rare.
their concerns?
The dissenting opinions, particularly the one written by Justice O'Connor, really highlight the other side of this complex debate. She argued that Jacobson's responses to those surveys and letters, particularly his, quote, eager responses when presented with solicitations for illegal materials, demonstrated that he was already predisposed.
So she's essentially saying that the government was simply revealing a pre-existing desire, even if it took 2 years of prodding to bring it out.
That's the gist of it.
Hmm.
She felt that the majority opinion was setting an unrealistic standard.
Right.
One that would make it incredibly difficult to prosecute these types of crimes.
Yeah.
Especially those that thrive on secrecy, like child pornography.
So we've got this clash between protecting the innocent from government overreach and ensuring that law enforcement can effectively investigate serious crimes.
Right.
It seems like a real tightrope walk.
And that's precisely what makes Jacobson such an important case, even decades later.
Right.
It forces us to grapple with these fundamental questions about the limits of government power and the nature of criminal intent.
It's a stark reminder that the law isn't always black and white. There are a lot of gray areas, and this case throws those gray areas into sharp relief.
Absolutely.
We've laid the groundwork here in part one, but there's so much more to explore.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So much more to unpack here.
A lot more to dig into.
Yeah.
Welcome back to our deep dive into Jacobson v. United States.
Yeah, we left off talking about the Supreme Court's split decision.
Right.
And that real tension between, law enforcement's needs and individual rights.
Exactly.
Now, let's examine how Jacobson impacted the legal landscape.
All right.
You mentioned earlier that Jacobson raised the bar for prosecutors in entrapment cases.
Yeah.
Can you break down exactly how it did that?
Absolutely. Jacobson didn't just decide a single case. It established a crucial precedent that continues to guide courts today.
Mm.
The majority opinion really emphasized that the government can't simply rely on a defendant's actions during an investigation to prove predisposition.
Okay.
They need to show clear evidence that existed independent of their involvement.
So it's not enough to just say, well, he eventually bought the illegal material, so he must have been predisposed.
Right.
They need more than that.
Exactly. Jacobson essentially forced a shift in focus from what happened during the investigation to what existed before the government got involved.
Hmm.
And this is where things get really interesting from a legal strategy standpoint.
This is definitely relevant for our listeners out there, in the legal world.
Absolutely.
How has this shift in focus impacted how lawyers approach these types of cases?
Well, for prosecutors, Jacobson means they need to be much more careful in building their cases.
Okay.
They can't just rely on a defendant's responses to undercover agents or informants.
Yeah.
They need to dig deeper, find independent evidence of predisposition.
Like what?
Things like prior convictions, searches on their computer, or statements to others.
It seems like that could be a pretty tough standard to meet, especially in cases where there's a lot of secrecy involved.
It can be, and that's precisely what the dissenting justices were concerned about.
Right.
They worried that this higher burden of proof would hamstring law enforcement, making it much harder to investigate and prosecute these types of crimes.
Right.
But the majority opinion held firm, emphasizing that protecting individual liberties from government overreach was paramount.
So this case created some powerful legal tools for defense attorneys, right?
It did. Jacobson provided a strong foundation for challenging the government's evidence in entrapment cases.
Okay.
If you're a defense attorney, you can now argue that the government's own actions created the criminal intent.
Right.
That they essentially entrapped your client into committing a crime they wouldn't have otherwise committed.
I imagine this case comes up a lot in legal arguments, even today.
All the time.
Yeah.
Jacobson has been cited in countless cases involving entrapment across a wide range of crimes.
Really?
Yeah. From drug offenses to terrorism.
Wow.
It's become a cornerstone of this area of the law, and its influence extends far beyond just child pornography cases.
So Jacobson isn't just some dusty old case that law students have to memorize.
It's a living, breathing legal precedent that's still shaping how justice is carried out.
Precisely. And it's not just about legal arguments in the courtroom.
Right.
It's also influenced how law enforcement agencies conduct investigations.
Right.
Especially in the age of online stings.
That's a great point. How has Jacobson shaped the way law enforcement approaches online investigations, where the potential for entrapment seems even greater?
Well, the core principles of Jacobson still apply.
Okay.
But the online world presents unique challenges.
Like what?
For example, how do you demonstrate predisposition when someone is browsing websites or participating in online forums that might contain illegal material? Is that enough to show they were already inclined to commit a crime?
It seems like a really murky area, especially with the anonymity that the internet provides.
Right.
Someone could stumble across something accidentally or out of curiosity without actually having any criminal intent.
That's right. And Jacobson forces law enforcement to be much more cautious in these online spaces. They need to be careful not to go too far in their efforts to engage with potential suspects.
Right.
Simply sending undercover agents into chat rooms or posing as someone interested in illegal material could be construed as inducement.
Right.
Especially if they're the ones initiating contact or pushing the conversation in a certain direction.
So law enforcement needs to be very strategic and have a solid legal basis before they start engaging with people online.
Exactly.
They can't just go on fishing expeditions hoping to catch someone in the act.
Yeah, they need to be able to demonstrate that the individual was already actively seeking out illegal material or engaging in criminal activity before law enforcement initiated contact.
Right.
And even then, they need to be very careful about how they interact with that individual.
Right.
Ensuring they don't cross the line into inducement.
It seems like Jacobson has made the online world a bit more of a legal minefield for law enforcement.
It has, but for good reason.
Right.
The potential for abuse is much greater in these online spaces, and Jacobson serves as a safeguard against government overreach.
Right.
It ensures that law enforcement can't simply lure people into committing crimes they wouldn't have otherwise considered.
So it's all about striking that delicate balance between effective law enforcement and protecting individual liberties.
Right.
And Jacobson provides a framework for navigating that complex terrain.
It does. It's a landmark case that continues to be relevant today, especially as technology evolves and the lines between online and offline worlds become increasingly blurred.
This has been an incredibly insightful look at the practical implications of Jacobson, both in the courtroom and in the ever-evolving world of online investigations.
Yeah, and in the final part of our deep dive, we'll delve even deeper into the legal arguments presented in Jacobson, exploring the nuances of the majority and dissenting opinions.
Okay.
We'll also examine some of the ethical dilemmas that entrapment raises, especially in the context of today's digital landscape.
Right.
So be sure to join us for part three as we wrap up our exploration of this fascinating and important case.
Welcome back to the final part of our deep dive into Jacobson v. United States. We've covered a lot of ground, you know, from the facts of the case to its impact on legal strategies and law enforcement practices.
Right.
Now let's really dig into the heart of the matter, the Supreme Court's reasoning.
Okay.
What's so fascinating about Jacobson is that it wasn't a clear-cut decision.
It wasn't.
The court was split 5-4.
Right.
Which really highlights, I think, you know, the complexity of the issues at play here.
It was a close one.
Yeah. It wasn't just about deciding whether Jacobson was guilty or not.
Right.
It was about, like, establishing a legal framework for dealing with entrapment.
Yeah.
And the justices had very different views on how to strike that balance.
Absolutely.
We touched on the dissenting opinions earlier, but I'd like to go deeper.
Okay.
Why were four justices so strongly opposed to the majority's decision?
Well, the dissenting opinions provide a really valuable counterpoint, especially for lawyers and law students who need to understand both sides of any argument.
Right. Correct.
Justice O'Connor, who wrote the main dissent, argued that the majority opinion was setting an unrealistically high bar for prosecutors in entrapment cases.
Hmm.
She felt that they were essentially requiring the government to have, quote, reasonable suspicion of criminal activity before even initiating an investigation, which could severely hamper law enforcement efforts.
That does seem like a tricky standard to meet, especially when dealing with crimes that are often shrouded in secrecy.
Right.
But wasn't her concern more about the practical implications of the decision?
Yeah.
Rather than the, like, legal principles themselves?
That's right. Her argument was more pragmatic.
Yeah.
She was worried that this decision would tie the hands of law enforcement, making it much harder to investigate and prosecute crimes like child pornography, where suspects aren't likely to openly admit their intentions.
Right.
She believed that the government's actions in Jacobson's case were justified, that they were simply revealing a predisposition that already existed.
So she felt that Jacobson's, quote, eager responses to the solicitations, even after 2 years of government pressure, demonstrated that he was already inclined to commit the crime. But how do you separate genuine intent from a response to, like, relentless pressure? That seems like a very gray area.
And that's precisely the point of contention.
Right.
The majority opinion, on the other hand, emphasized the dangers of government overreach.
Nowhere.
They argued that the government shouldn't be in the business of manufacturing criminals.
Right.
They can't implant an idea in someone's mind and then punish them for acting on it.
Right.
They were particularly concerned about the techniques used in Jacobson's case, arguing that they went beyond simply providing an opportunity.
Yeah.
And crossed the line into actively inducing him to commit a crime.
So they weren't just concerned about Jacobson's individual rights. Mm-hmm. They were worried about setting a dangerous precedent for future cases.
Exactly. The majority opinion really highlighted the importance of the entrapment defense as a safeguard against government abuse.
Right.
They saw it as a crucial protection for individual liberties, ensuring that the government can't use its power to unfairly target and manipulate people into committing crimes.
It's like they were drawing a line in the sand saying, like, this far and no further.
Hmm.
It seems like Jacobson provides a framework for navigating this complex legal terrain.
It does.
But it doesn't necessarily offer easy answers.
It's not a simple formula.
Right.
Every case is different, and courts need to carefully weigh the specific facts and circumstances
right.
to determine whether entrapment occurred.
Right.
But Jacobson gives us some crucial guideposts.
Yeah.
It emphasizes the importance of independent evidence of predisposition, the dangers of government inducement, and the need to protect individual liberties from overzealous law enforcement tactics.
So for our listeners out there in the legal world, Jacobson is much more than just a case to study for an exam.
Right.
It's a living legal precedent that continues to shape how we think about entrapment and the limits of government power. It's a reminder that the law is constantly evolving.
Yeah.
And cases like this one help us grapple with complex questions about justice, fairness, and the balance between security and freedom.
Absolutely. And as technology advances and we move further into the digital age, the principles established in Jacobson will become even more important.
Right.
As we've discussed, online investigations present unique challenges.
Yeah.
And understanding the nuances of entrapment is crucial for ensuring that the government's pursuit of justice doesn't come at the expense of individual rights.
Well, this deep dive has given us all a lot to think about.
It has.
It's a reminder that the law is never static. And landmark cases like Jacobson v. United States continue to shape the legal landscape for generations to come.
Absolutely.
For our listeners who want to delve deeper, we encourage you to read the full text of the decision, explore the arguments presented by both sides, and consider how the principles established in Jacobson might apply to the legal challenges we face in today's world.